see it too. Is that cable in the way of that camera?
And then I go the Freddie Mercury style with no bass.
What do you do? Hold it?
Yeah, I just kind of hold it. I don't know. I've always just done this because otherwise, I like, I don't know. I talk with my hands and this kind of makes it so I have to sit a little bit normal.
I gotcha.
Okay. So you were saying a second ago that you make music.
Yep.
What kind of music do you make?
Mainly, classic rock, folk, 70s type stuff.
Ooh, do you like the Dead?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, grab the mic. We're about to go down on the tangent. This is what Jackson's been waiting for years.
Oh, dude, I'm a huge Grateful Dead fan.
Are you going to the Sphere?
No.
Well, we were trying to get people to go to the Sphere for the Dead
concert. So I didn't realize it was a Dead concert at the Sphere. My wife and I were just talking recently about going to the Sphere to see you too.
Dude, I heard it's really cool. You can literally take that off the ceiling.
Okay, this did not show up.
Did it really?
Until I moved it. I swear to God,
That's funny.
Was so confused.
Is it okay if I vape?
Yeah, no, I don't give a shit. There's very little fucks given here.
Sick, if you're too far away from the microphone, we'll get uneven audios, and then I'll get in trouble by my producer, Jackson.
Does it need to be right here?
Yeah, something like that. And we have these cranked up pretty high, okay. So you can talk around. We have like the, what is it? Cardioid
pattern.
Yeah, so I like you'll watch the videos and I'm like talking all over the place with the microphone and it sounds like absolute garbage. It's ridiculous.
Cardioid, omnidirectional. Looks like some condenser mics here.
Yeah, these were a gift from WYCE.
What are they? What's the name of
them? They're Nady 1000s or Nady, okay. Yeah, Nady SCM Studio Condenser Mic.
I have a Shure SM7B.
Oh, Shure's a really good microphone.
Phenomenal
right?
Microphone. It's nothing crazy. It's great for vocals and it's great for audio for podcasts too.
Yeah, so are you going to have the kids record at your place then?
They do record at my place.
Do you have like a studio style place?
I have a nice interface and several microphones, and I do, mostly acoustic guitar.
Ooh.
So I sing and play guitar, and my son does too.
He's just in a band together?
We're not. No. He was in a band for a little while.
Really?
Yeah, he's 20, so
he's that age.
He's that age, so he plays guitar, drums, keyboard. He's very talented.
He's gonna go to school for music, eh?
He's not. He's gonna go into the insurance business.
Oh, okay.
Which I've convinced him is a smart way to go economically.
You can go be a rock star or insurance.
I always tell him like, hey, look, build a business, okay, and then you can do whatever you want with your time. And if you want to play music, you can play music.
What is it, Brian May from Queen?
He's an astrophysicist.
Yeah, he was an astrophysicist, then decided to become a rock star.
Yeah,
so
right.
Makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were saying a second ago about the Grateful Dead.
Yes.
So have you seen them with John Mayer yet?
Never. No. Never? John Mayer playing with the Grateful Dead. That's awesome.
Dude.
I love John Mayer.
He rips, dude. Dead & Co.
Okay.
So controversial opinion. And okay. Jackson's going to cut this up and make it a clip.
Okay.
I think, I know that I listen to more Dead & Co. with John Mayer
than I do
Grateful Dead. Okay. I don't know if I can say I like Dead & Co. more. It is a different vibe, though. It is more like, I don't want to say like heady, but it's more like boppy.
Okay.
You know, like,
yeah, it's got the Mayer vibe.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Poppy.
Yeah, I would say even poppy, but like not in like a negative way. It's okay. like, you know. When Jerry was around and what the Dead were, they were kind of like designing a style of music. And, Bill and Mickey, they both are very like, they have their influence there.
Mm-hmm.
And when like Jeff Schimenti came in to play the keyboards, he kind of fell in the footsteps of like an evolution of keyboardists. So there's like a very significant line of what he's responsible for doing.
Mm-hmm.
And when O'Teal took over for Phil, right, it was, you know, similar thing. It's like there's a very specific like set of rules with which you guys can break the rules.
Absolutely.
Right. And then John came into a position where he's like following behind a deity, right? And he's in a position where he will never be able to imitate or mimic what Jerry did, but what Jerry means to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
but he can play that same role and put his spin on it. And I think that, you know, everyone else kind of follows suit. Bobby sounds different mm-hmm. when he's playing with Dead & Co. than when he's playing with Wolf Bros.
Okay.
Right? Wolf Bros sounds more like what you would hear from the Grateful Dead. But Bobby's out there. He's like bopping around, playing. It's different. It is different. And it's like it's a good difference, like a healthy mm-hmm. evolution.
Have you seen them live with Mayer?
Yeah, about 17 times. okay. Yeah, I've never seen. Obviously, you know, I was 3 years old when
too
Jerry
young,
died.
Yeah, to see the
and when what was it 2007 when they went to Soldier Field with Trey Anastasio yep. and Phil Lesh.
Yep.
You know, I was a sophomore in high school,
okay,
maybe a junior, so I knew what Grateful Dead was. I thought I was into Fishmore, but that was just because I was young and dumb. And I didn't know the significance of them playing there, so I didn't go see them. I kind of regret that, but it wasn't until I don't want to say like later in life sounds really bad because I'm a relatively young guy still,
uh-huh.
but it wasn't until like I was an adult. And I would start listening to, like, the Dead to go, like, I want to go see this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, like, be a part of this. Because, you know, I have all the albums. I've got all the albums. I got all the CDs. And the songs are different than the music.
Mm.
And it wasn't until, I don't know, I started listening to the music more than just the songs. I was like, yo, I got to go catch this bug. And I went to, my first show was 2015, I think it would have been at Wrigley.
Hmm.
I saw they played two nights in a row. I was like, well, I'll just go to one night.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the Saturday show and I ran into a bunch of my friends from high school there. And they're like, were you here last night? And I was like, you guys go to both shows? And they were like, yeah, that's the thing. And I was like, oh, okay. And it was out of control. It was so much fun. And the next year I went to both shows and I was like, oh, dude, this is a different ball game we're playing now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's it's just great. Like, John gets after it. O'Teal's awesome. Bill Kreutzmann? I don't know. He always says his name differently. He still was playing with him for a while, but now Jay Lane is drumming. There's so much. Like, it's just so good. It's still good.
Who is the keyboardist again?
So the new one's Jeff Schimenti.
How long has he been with him?
I mean, I would... What's his face? Since what's his face died? Who's the guy with like not Alligator Rock? Elton John.
Yeah,
that was Elton John. But who's the guy that has the song by Alligator on his own album? Pigpen, but Pigpen died, and then McKean.
Yeah,
and then there's somebody between those.
But the most recent
is Jeff Schimenti.
Jeff Schimenti. So he has a YouTube video where he goes through all his gear.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he talks about every piece of gear. What it does, what songs he uses it on. I mean, it's really cool.
Dude, do you know who, not Joey Bosa, but there's another rock guy that I was listening to recently. I just found out about recently, and he's got like the biggest guitar collection I've ever seen in my life. There's a picture of him online. You can Google it. It's the size of a basketball court.
Really?
Yeah, well, I cannot remember his name. I really should have been prepared before I just brought that
up. You know, Mark Knopfler just sold, like, his huge guitar collection. You know who Mark Knopfler is?
Dire Straits?
Dire Straits, yeah. Huge Dire Straits fan. God, I love Dire Straits.
I like so good. I like Mark Knopfler quite a bit. Sailing to Philadelphia. What is that? Not Taj Mahal. Shangri-La.
That's great.
That's such a great album. It's so much different than anything he does.
He's a really phenomenal musician. One of my favorite guitarists of all time. And I find myself sometimes watching old YouTube videos like him and Chet Atkins, you know what I mean? Back in Mark Knopfler's early career. Like I'm kind of a nerd into that stuff.
YouTube is such an amazing tool nowadays.
It is unbelievable. It sounds
so like dorky, but like to be able to go back and like watch old concerts.
It's one of the best things.
I think it's changed a lot of like younger musicians' perspective on music. Cause like, after college and even in college, like the only thing I listened to was what was available to me. Like it was really difficult to get a hold of live albums.
Absolutely.
And the access to live albums on YouTube, it's just like, oh, okay, this is a whole new thing.
Ridiculous.
Like there's a whole new world. You know, I had listened to a couple of BB King albums, and then I'd seen like a BB King show,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, oh, okay, we gotta go do this thing. It's the same thing with like, it's just like, I don't know. Music has a different entity. Right. Hey Jackson, is that slowing down up there, by the way, the ticker? The ticker? What? On the podcast. No, up there on the actual. This is really bad of me. I'm trying to get better at this. Do you see the ticker on the actual? Is it the recording thing? Is it going?
It's going, yeah.
Okay. I saw it like open up. All right, we can just delete that whole thing. I'm a goofball. Anyways, I think that music. I think that like being able to access music, the way that we have the ability to access music, is going to change the generation after millennials' taste of music. Right.
Yeah, I think that you know what you have access to on YouTube. In terms of new artists and their ability to share their content with an entire platform without having to go through the typical channels of a recording industry and the radio, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I have so many artists I follow on YouTube that aren't really commercially that successful, but I personally know they're just amazing musicians, mm-hmm. and I'll go see them and I follow them.
Yeah. And it's going back to, I mean, like, originally, the way that you made music was, like, touring.
Yep.
And then it went to, like, record sales was how you paid the bills, and now it's going back to the touring. Yep. And I think that that's turning music back to what it used to be. Because there was a period of time where, like, we were becoming a playlist culture, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, here's this new pop song, and then people just listen to that song on repeat. Whereas, like, now it's like, I'm going to go see this artist. There's so many artists that I know, like, one or two songs from. And they're in town. I was like, I'm going to go. Whatever. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
It worth $20.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, there really is a lot of great music out there. Sometimes people say things like, oh, you know, the music that's being created today isn't as good as the music that was created in the 70s. You know, and I tend to disagree. I mean, obviously there was some amazing music that was created in the 70s. But there's a lot of great music being created today. You know, it's just a little bit of a different way it's being delivered to the market.
It's also survivorship bias, right? Like, the music, we were like, oh, music back in the day is so much better because you only hear the good stuff that survived.
Yeah, right.
There was some garbage music.
There was some garbage
music. Even, like, some of the best bands came out with bad. Like, anytime that Donna sings with the Dead, that's garbage music to me. Okay?
That's good stuff.
Another band that's like Chilliwack. You ever heard of Chilliwack?
Never.
Chilliwack's kind of that same like Marshall Tucker Band genre. I
freaking love Marshall Tucker Band.
And
dude,
they've got like one album that's pretty good, and then the rest of the music is like, yo, you guys need to put this animal down.
This is not it.
This is not the move.
Oh, what's your favorite Marshall Tucker Band song?
I mean, I don't know. Can't You See So Damn Good? It's so far above the rest.
Desert Skies. Love Desert Skies. That's a great song.
I could get down.
Dude, they're a great band. That's funny that you mentioned them. Most people don't even know who Marshall Tucker is.
They came to Grand Rapids like a couple years ago.
Are you serious?
When I was at Dexia, they came.
Really?
Yeah, they came with like...
Oh, that's great.
A whole bunch of other guys who's there. Like, I don't want to say one-hit wonders, but like, you're like, oh, they're the one that played that song, right?
Yeah, we just saw the Eagles live in Caesars.
With What's-His-Face's son. Isn't What's-His-Face's son playing with
Deacon,
them?
Deacon Fry was in the band, and Steve Miller Band opened for him. Steely Dan was supposed to open for him. Which would have been...
Well, it's not even Steel Dan. It's one of the guys now.
Well, it's Donald Fagen, which, you know, that's good. So it would have been. But
I saw Steely Dan at the Van Antle.
Really?
Yeah.
Recently? Walter Becker died a couple years ago.
It was right after. I think they were on tour when Walter Becker died, right? Yeah. And I think that they started the second half of the tour, and it was on, like, the second half of the tour,
well,
I think.
I love Donald Fagen, and he tours sometimes with Bob Skaggs and a few other guys, but they have a whole, like, separate...
The Boz. One of my favorite jokes, and this is such a niche joke, is I think it's crazy that The Boz made such a transition from being a college football star to jazz music.
I didn't know he was a college football player.
No, it's The Boz, is that guy that played for Oklahoma.
That's right. Oh, gosh. The one hit, right? The tackle, right?
Yeah, the guy had, like, the shaved side of his head.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the only two Boz that I know.
Didn't he even have, like it was not only just his shaved side of his head, but there was, like, the 90s, like, you know, dagger. Like
lightning,
like,
bolts,
lightning,
right?
Bolts. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, well, yeah, for sure, dude.
I used to think, when I was younger, I used to think they're the same person. I was like, there's no way there's more than one Boz, right? And then my dad took me to go see Boz Skaggs.
Like, come on, this is a different Boz, man. It's totally different. So your dad did a good job, you know, teaching you good music was. I could tell.
My dad. So growing up, my dad had a massive stereo system in the house. And it had, like, 2 400 CD changers. And I was kind of an audiophile at a young age. I liked to listen to, like, not so much the music, but like the quality of the music, which is kind of like dorky, but you know, when you're young and have little friends in the summer, sometimes you find stuff
so,
to do.
I can so relate to this, but you know,
yeah. And my dad was like, you can listen to anything on my speakers as long as it's my music.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, all right, let's do that. So that's kind of how I went through it. I was like, oh, what is this band here or whatever? And my dad
just explore.
Yeah, exactly. My dad also wouldn't let me put digital files through the speakers.
Really?
Yeah, he's like, even though you can hook these up, you're like not putting digital files through those speakers.
Only analog.
Yeah, he's like, those are Virgin speakers. You don't get to fuck up my speakers.
That's awesome. Right.
But I've got, like, because of him, I've got a set of Klipsch Heresy 2s and 3s.
Ooh.
That have never played a digital file.
Okay.
They've only played CDs, so I guess it might be a digital file, but they played CDs. And played records.
What's the advantage there of no digital files?
I don't know. I think it's just a pretentious audio file thing. But also, one of the issues, and this is actually a true thing, is that digital files, you can crank the input on way easier when it's coming out of your cell phone or your computer.
Right.
And that might not be healthy for a speaker. But
okay, I see.
Otherwise, it's definitely just because we're being pretentious.
Okay.
But my dad was in the music industry growing up. He used to like own a music venue.
Really?
Yeah, like a blues bar.
Like in town here, local?
In Chicago.
Okay.
So.
I love blues. I love blues.
So we went, Jackson, were you with us when we went to, what is it? What is the name of the grocery store that has bands?
Horrocks.
Have you been to Horrocks to see live music?
No.
Horrocks has live music on Thursdays and Fridays.
I've never heard of that.
You know what Horrocks is?
No.
Horrocks is on 44th Street and Breton.
Okay. It's a grocery store that has live music.
Yeah, but it's like a different. It's not like. It's less of a Myers and more of like a J.B. Russo's.
Okay.
It's like somewhere between J.B. Russo's and Whole Foods.
Okay.
And they have live music in their atrium.
Okay.
And they serve beer and it's all thing.
Okay.
But I went to go see them a little bit and it was like this guy was just like playing. It was like this guy and his son and a couple of their friends, like young guys. Like it was like young guys and old guys on the same stage. And they were just playing like every classic blues band you would know of.
Wow.
And like for somebody that's like into music, you know, it was just good music. So there's a bunch of young people there and they're like, oh, this is fun. And I was like, yo, that was Albert King. And they're like, cool. What does that mean?
Yeah.
I was like, that's B.B. King. I was like, are those guys related? No, they're not related, but.
That's good. You're doing the instruction while,
I'm trying
while
it's
best. Going on. That's awesome.
I would highly recommend everybody goes to that.
Okay.
Let's
check that out.
Yeah, dude. It was sweet. And, like, the beers are pretty inexpensive. I didn't realize you couldn't bring your own beers in. Side note, you can't bring your beers into the grocery store.
You can drink a couple in the parking lot if you want, but you can't take them in.
Yeah, dude, it's like going to a concert.
That's awesome.
Well, I guess since we have you here, we can introduce you.
Yes, absolutely.
So Jason Barup.
That's right.
Nice and short. Is Barup, like, what heritage is that, for starters?
Well, I've done a little research on it.
Did you do 23andMe?
No, my wife did 23andMe. I did not do 23andMe. But my sister for a while was kind of into the whole genealogy thing. So I was kind of curious, you know, what is Barup and where did it come from? It's not that common of a name. You know, it's Scottish.
Scottish.
Yep. Scottish and English. You know, of course, it changed when people came to Ellis Island. It was something a little bit different in terms of what it was, you know, a couple hundred years ago or whatever. But yeah.
Did you see that 23andMe is getting sued? For selling everyone's data. There's a surprise, right?
Not a shocker at all.
Not a shocker at all.
Not even like slightly surprised by that. That's why I made my wife do it. So I didn't have to give my data. I was so curious, but I was like, hey, look, I'll get you this for Christmas and we'll see what your heritage is.
So I did Ancestry.
Okay.
And I found a long lost uncle for our family.
Really?
Yeah. This guy was like my uncle and he was like, hey, I'm related to you, I think. And I was like, I told my dad, I was like, hey, this guy reached out to me. He said he's related to us on your side of the family. I think it's a scam. And my dad was like, let me see. And he was like, yeah, this is definitely a scam. And then I click on the guy's profile and we pull the picture up. It looks exactly like my fucking dad.
And you're like, okay, it's not a scam.
It's not a scam,
we're
Ted.
We're totally related, dude.
It's not a scam, Ted. This guy's fucking related to you, man.
Oh, that's funny. That's awesome. So my wife found out that she's the whitest girl you've ever seen in your life, but she has like 1% African in her background, you know, like, which is crazy.
That's cool, though.
When you think about like all of, like, you know, we're all whatever, you know, mixed breed puppies or whatever you want to call it. But it's cool to see, you go back and see like, wow, this is where you came from. You know what I mean? Because my wife doesn't really have a lot of information about her family, because her father passed away when she was very young. Mm-hmm. And so she, you know, now that she did the 23andMe, now she has all these connections to people who are her family. She didn't have them before.
I guess it's interesting. I've never been in this situation. But like, both sides of my family are very like strong on genealogy, right? Like my mom's side of the family, they have a massive, like they roll it out like it's a map to find the treasure. But yeah, like our family tree,
they have it,
and it's like drawn in pencil, and it's like open to continue. And like I open it up, and like there's my name, and then there's a branch underneath me waiting for kids. Luis, up to it. You got a job to do.
So we used to pick on my wife because her grandma used to always say, "Oh yeah, we're part Native American." You know, so I would call my wife Pocahontas just to mess with her.
get her going.
You know, just to get her going. And it turns out she has no Native American at all. So this is like some family, you know, story that is, has no basis in truth.
She'll be fine, though. She can just run for office.
She's fine. Exactly. I was like, look, babe, you got to, you know, yeah, we can roll with this.
So you know my old boss.
I do.
Ken.
Yep.
I heard you guys were telling stories about me. Anything good?
Well, so Ken let me know, you know, hey, Luis, when I first started working with Luis, he was really, 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 you know,
unhinged,
raw sales guy. I had to really polish him up. He would go to meetings and he would, you know, tap on the table while the people were talking and like, you know, just funny stories that he would tell me that he would have to like tell you. He's like, why? Well, it was tough love. It was just tough love.
I would used to click my pen all the time.
He said that.
Yeah, and then one day he showed up with a box of pens that have caps on them. He goes, these are your new pens.
That's hilarious. So Ken is like your typical, prototypical, like he's not a baby boomer, but he might as well kind of be a baby boomer because he's still like in that era.
Yeah, he's so a Gen Xer, though.
He's
right?
He's a Gen Xer. But like when people like don't behave like young people did 30 years ago, like it causes like internal stresses in Ken, and yes, he has a difficult time sometimes coping with that.
It's so funny. He's like, I really, really want the best for you, Luis, but you need to do this also for me.
He's great. So.
Now, Ken was great for me when I was at Dexia. He is true. I was like, I'd like to say raw, undiscovered talent, but I was just like raw and unhinged. Like
that's a little bit kind of how Ken described it.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I would just come out of selling beer.
You gotta polish this guy up.
Yeah, I mean, I was selling beer for a couple of years, you know.
Yeah. And then now you're getting into a professional sales environment for the first time, and someone's there with some business experience and some sales background, and kind of coaching you up a little bit.
Yeah, and everyone's like, I kind of like this guy, but he's kind of an idiot.
I don't think they thought that.
But you know, Ken and I, yeah, Ken helped a lot. Ken came in, so I was kind of at Dexia, I don't want to say on my own, because Joshua, one of the guys that owns Dexia, was definitely a huge help to me. But like it was just me doing the sales, one of the partners, and then yeah, that was it. And then Ken came in, who's an adult that knows how to sell stuff,
yeah,
and really helped a ton. Just like, all right, so we're going to do systems. We'll start there.
Yeah, we're going to have some processes. Things are going to be a little bit more, you know, outlined instead of just, you know, off the cuff.
And, like, it's true. Like, I was used to, like, selling beer to people that were already buying it. You know, like, it's pretty easy just to sell more beer to a restaurant or sell more beer to the Intersection or sell more beer to Meijer.
Right.
You're just like, well, you should buy this one ale.
People will love it.
Yeah.
They already buy beer, you know, try this one.
Yeah, I'll make an end cap for you. And like,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's super easy. Then all of a sudden you're trying to like sell them. Hey, you should buy these $100,000 a year marketing services. You should fuck yourself.
This is an enterprise sale. It's a completely different, totally different setup. So, right?
Dude, I got thrown to the wolves. But I would not say I thrived, but I did it. I survived. And then I don't know if he told you why I left.
No, he didn't tell me.
I mean, we'll say this sentence without the names because it's going to get cut up. But I had a little bit of an encounter with one of the partners.
Okay.
Yeah, we were doing an event, and like a quarterly event.
Yep.
And we all had to go to the bathroom at one of our breaks, and I had to take a sales call, like not
pitch somebody, but like a call for one of my clients.
Yep.
And like, well, everywhere else go to the bathroom. Then I went to the bathroom. And then I came back and I was late. The boss told me I needed to sing and dance because I was late. I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm sorry. Like, I'm not singing and dancing in front of the team. I'm so sorry.
He literally wanted you to sing.
Yeah. And he goes, this is insubordination. And I was like, no, it's not. He goes, your dad owns a business. What would he do if his team was being insubordinate? I go, my dad's not a fucking child, so this would never happen. That was my last day.
That's probably the end of it there.
You know, it's called growth.
Right.
I definitely stood up for myself, and I feel really proud of myself. I also lost my fucking job.
Right. I've been fired from one job in my entire life, and it was somewhat recently.
Recently? Oh, that's when you went out and started.
When I went out and started on my own. Yep. So I was working with a firm. I won't name them, but you know, it was a small benefits department, and my task was to take over this benefits department and grow it into its own separate entity, its own profit center, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this business had been in this firm had been in business for a long time, over 100 years, and they were a $4 million a year.
Was it just insurance?
Okay. Personal lines type stuff. They had a few commercial benefits type clients. They wanted me to come in and kind of revamp that whole thing and grow that channel of the business. Well, I had a plan. And I laid it out for him. And, you know, in the first 12 months I was there, we did like $220,000 in annual recurring revenue, which is pretty significant for a $4 million a year business.
Yeah.
Right. And I had a lot of other things in the pipeline. And
it's enough to employ you as a department.
Quite a bit. Yeah. And so, you know, we basically sat down and I said, okay, look, this business is right now, it's $500,000 a year. You know, and in 4 years, it'll be the same size as the one that you have over here that took 100 and whatever years to build.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like from a partnership standpoint? Yeah, right. Yeah. And that conversation kind of just didn't
got go. Real cold.
It got cold. Yeah, it just didn't go the direction I wanted it to go. And I just thought to myself, well, look, I'm not going to take the 20 years of expertise that I have and come in and build a business for you and then just walk, you know, not have any. equity in it. I mean, that's crazy. I'm just not going to do that. I couldn't get any common ground. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to start my own.
So that was what I was going to ask is like, how did Ken has explained to me what Nexus Benefit Solutions is.
Yep.
Right. I kind of understand it and you can definitely pitch it, but like, is this like a thing that you knew of? Is this like, are you doing something that's like, it's like a common knowledge, just nobody's applying it here? Are you like, did you find a loophole? Who's losing? Like, how does this, where did this originate from? Not so much where did you start the business from, but like, where did this idea program come from?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so I've been in the insurance business for, I mean, almost 20 years, and I've done a variety of different things. I started out, you know, consulting with individuals, like selling life insurance. You know, that was like my first foray into the business. I got a job with Northwestern Mutual.
Did you get a suit when they gave you?
Definitely had to wear a suit.
For don't sure. They give you a suit now?
They don't give you a suit, but they say you got to wear a suit. Like, this is like, you know, back in, like, I just gotten out of the military. If you told me I was going to get in insurance sales, I would have been like, you're crazy. Like,
you were an officer in the military, weren't you?
I was a non-commissioned officer.
So I don't know what that means, but we
so can. you've got officers and you've got non-commissioned officers. Officers are your, you know, your brass. They're the ones that went to college and kind of are the executive leadership. The non-commissioned officers are your guys on the ground that kind of came up through the system and are kind of your ground leaders.
Okay. You know what I mean? So like the journeyman turned into a master plumber.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So I was a non-commissioned officer and I got out of the military and got into sales, which I never thought I was going to do. Like, I just wasn't something I was thinking of doing. And got involved in sales, loved it. I got started in the insurance business and just realized that there's just a significant amount of opportunity in our business. Our business is a very, how do I say it? It's a very aging business.
Insurance? Because it's not sexy.
It's not sexy. And I mean, if you talk to the average 19-year-old in college, I guarantee not a single one of them is like, yeah, I'm going into the insurance business.
The only ones that do are the ones that are in an insurance business family.
Right. That's it. So
every person I know that's my age in the insurance industry is their family owns the insurance firm.
Yeah. And then that's how they kind of recognize that, wait, this is a pretty attractive industry to be in. Mm-hmm. And way maybe I can make as much as I would have went to medical school and become a doctor for 8 years. And I can do the same thing as a business professional in the insurance world.
One of the things that's crazy about insurance, I don't want to break this off, is that some of it pays in perpetuity.
I have a friend of mine whose father passed away, mm-hmm. and they're still getting checks for the work that his dad did.
Absolutely.
And I was just like, that's dope.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, like, you know, business in general, anything with recurring revenue is where you want to be, right? I mean, obviously, one-time sales, great, and you get that revenue. But when you're consistently consulting with someone over time, and that revenue is repeatable and you know, predictable, that's where you can build something that is, you know, significant.
I don't know if Ken told you, but after I left Dexia, I tried to go out on my own. And
on the marketing side of things?
Yeah, okay. I was building websites. Mm-hmm. I was working with contractors, and we did a great job. Like, we had a lot of clients. But the problem was, is I didn't have, like, what happens after you build a website for somebody?
Right.
You host it and charge them $500 a year? Sweet.
Like, right, right. How do we build in a recurring revenue stream where mm-hmm. we're getting paid, but we're, you know, providing a valuable service?
Yeah, and the hard part is like, you try to bring on a digital marketer, and the digital marketer's like, wait, I can just go do this myself. Get out of here.
Exactly.
But, yeah. So, Nexus Benefits, sorry.
Yeah, so, like, the insurance industry itself, I mean, back to kind of what I was saying, it's an aging industry, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people that have been in this business for years and years and years, they don't have succession plans. So, there's a ton of private equity in the space buying up a lot of these, you know, firms that didn't have you know, an exit plan. So what that's creating for guys like me and Ken is a huge opportunity for organic growth, because a lot of these firms that worked with, you know, Bill, their broker, for the last 30 years, Bill just sold his firm to some big private equity company, and some private equity company's coming in, they're doing cut costs and doing everything they can, the service is going down. Now this firm is working with, you know, this family company that they've been working with for the last 20 years, and it's not the same anymore. Mm-hmm. And guys like me that are still independently owned, and we're out there going, hey, we're still here, we're still providing the same level of service. You know, there's such a huge opportunity out there.
I
guess I'll give you the floor to explain how Nexus works, because it's not just like, you guys aren't just selling insurance. You're not just like, hey, buy insurance from us. There's kind of a shtick.
There is
a shtick. That sounds like,
yeah. There's definitely a market differentiator. There's a go to market strategy for our business, right? I mean, if you look at the business, the insurance business as a whole, right? It has a distribution channel just like any other business does. You know, any business that manufactures a product and they, you know, put it in distribution centers, and they have wholesalers and retailers, and that product moves from, you know, manufacturer down to the end buyer. The same, you know, process exists in the insurance, in the professional services world, especially on the insurance side of things. Mm-hmm. So you have the retail broker who's out there consulting with companies, and they're meeting with the business owner, and they're talking about, hey, you need this insurance and this insurance and this insurance, and this is how we can help you structure your plans and save you money and get you better coverage, right? Mm-hmm. Nexus Benefit Solutions is a solutions provider built for the end broker. So we are really a wholesale shop that puts, you know, healthcare solutions together that typically our retail broker then goes and sells to the client.
So you guys are not calling like Spectrum or nope. stuff like that. You're calling like local agencies.
Local agencies, yeah. Your middle market firms. The middle market for us is, you know, this employers with 50 employees to 300 employees, right? Yeah. Those firms that are servicing those employers, those are the firms that we work with. Those are our clients.
Got it. And then can you explain, so I understand the concept of concierge medicine.
Sure.
And I know that that's like a huge part of like the circle that makes the business, right?
Yeah.
How does the concierge part of the business, I guess, hold on, let me take a step back. Concierge medicine has always been this like bourgeois thing for me.
Sure, yeah.
Right? And then it sounds like you guys have a way to get concierge for free. So it sounds like you're selling, almost like you're selling snake oil, but it sounds like someone has to pay for it.
Yeah.
Who's paying for it, and how does it not get a worse product or a worse price for the buyer?
Yeah. Well, so we have a number of different strategies in terms of how a company can acquire our services and put them into practice, into their business. And one of the ways a company can do that is through a creative insurance, an indemnity insurance product that will allow them to basically underwrite the cost of what we're doing. And we could talk a little bit about that, but there are some companies that doesn't make sense for them for whatever reason, You know, there's a number of factors. Bureaucracy, how many decision makers are involved in the organization, is there private equity money involved? There's a lot of decision-making factors that go into how do we actually take concierge medicine and get it into the hands of the, you know, rank and file employee so that their experience with healthcare is significantly better than it is today.
Got it. And, okay. And what is included? I guess we can talk about that, but like, what is included or what what is the problem that the person is going to be solving, both the consumer and the company?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the problem is really can be summarized in this way, I think. So when you talk about healthcare, right, and if I ask an average business owner, you know, a couple hundred employees, Luis, what's your experience like with healthcare?
It's a circus. It is a liability, not an asset.
Yeah. And you get different responses, right? Sometimes people will tell you how good their insurance is, right? You ask them what their experience like is with healthcare. Well, I have great insurance. We have Priority Health, or we have Blue Cross and Blue Shield, or whatever. They immediately start telling you what their insurance benefits are. Mm. And you have to step back and go, okay, let's put that aside for a minute. Insurance is a tool, right, that helps you pay for medical care. That's all it is, okay? But when you go to use medical care, have a conversation with your doctor, try to deal with a situation with a sick kid, mm-hmm. or you have a chronically ill family member who's dealing with cancer, God forbid, something like that. What has your experience been like?
It makes you want to jump off a bridge.
Exactly.
It is the worst experience consistently today. Okay.
So, I mean, that is definitely some of the feedback that we get, right? And some of the feedback that we get are from people who are, for lack of a better term, a little aloof to what's going on because they're really healthy, or they just don't really pay attention.
This is true.
Right? And so they think, well, we have great insurance. Our employees are very happy. And you're like, well, have you really talked to your employees about what their experience is like on a day-to-day basis when they try to go get medical care? If you really get to that conversation with an employer and you really can break through that, then the comments come out like what you're making. It's terrible. It's a maze. You know, the average physician is managing 3,000 patients.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, they spend all of their time, keying in electronic medical records all day long. Because the way our medical system is set up is a fee-for-service, right? So if you go to see your doctor probably works for Spectrum Health.
Corewell Health.
Corewell Health.
Sounds like a yoga studio.
Right? So in Corewell Health, owns Priority Health. Priority Health is your insurer, right? So there's all kinds of conflicts of interest that are layered into that arrangement, right? Mainly being the fee-for-service arrangement, meaning your doctor, when he sees you, the more he pokes you, tests you, talks to you, the more he can bill your insurance company, and then their revenues go up as a medical provider, right? Not really the greatest structure for the consumer.
Yeah.
Right?
Even for the doctor, it doesn't allow them to do the best job that they can do.
That's a great point. A lot of doctors, I mean, if you just do some cursory Google searching on the frustration that physicians have within our current medical system, you know, that's the whole impetus behind a lot of these independent practices that we see popping up, like locally, like Health Bar. Or, you know, up north, there's another group that we're working with called Table Health. Mm-hmm. These are physician groups that have basically jettisoned themselves away from the system. And they set themselves up in an independent practice where they don't bill insurance. And they're not owned by, a major conglomerate. They're an independent practice. They bill you a monthly membership fee. And you get access to their team unlimited 24/7, 365. They have no other incentive other than to help you, right? From a navigation standpoint, setting appointments, second opinions, your doctor prescribes you an MRI, you have a $5,000 deductible, you're the one paying for that MRI because you're not going to hit your deductible on a single MRI. You might be valuable information for you, Luis, to know that locally you could go to M1 Imaging in town and get an MRI for $300. And if your doctor schedules it at Spectrum, it's probably going to be $1,800 or $2,000.
So your customers are the end consumers, but the team that you work with is the health bar or the one up in Traverse City, correct?
Sure, yep, and we have some that are national medical providers. The goal is this. The goal is really, like, how can we get into a business, right, and say to them, hey, what if your employees had access to a medical team 24/7, 365? I use this analogy. Sometimes it's not the best analogy, but I think it's a good one. Like the Detroit Lions. We all love the Lions, right? You know, like however many players.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace. This year they did great. Still a good year, right? They have an entire staff of players that make millions of dollars, right? They have an entire medical team dedicated to taking care of these players. These players don't pay copays. They don't set appointments with physicians. They just go right to the team. Mm-hmm. If they need an X-ray, they do it right there. If they need an MRI, they do it right there. So,
and then the health bars or whatever act as that team. There you go. Guys are paying for it.
There you go. Right? So what if your employees all had access to a medical team like that that had no incentive to bill your insurance company for more services?
And also now that's what you were talking about at the beginning of this is like, oh, I got great insurance. But now what you talk about your healthcare is my interface, my interaction with healthcare is through Health Bar or A1 up north. This is my experience. No matter who provides it, this is who I talk to about it.
Yeah. I mean, if you think of the average individual, you know, just median income, right, making $50,000 a year, right, and you are, as an employer, you're giving them insurance,
mm-hmm.
and you're paying for it. I'm providing my employees insurance.
There's only $5,000, $8,000 on top of it.
Right. And then to that $15 or $16 an hour person, you have taken their medical liability from unlimited down to $5,000 or whatever their deductible is.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care. They don't have any financial assets. They don't care about protecting their financial assets against some major medical issue, because for them, if you're a $30,000 a year employee with a $5,000 deductible, and God forbid something major happened to you and you had no insurance whatsoever, you would get taken care of and you would not get billed. You would be in some Medicaid system and so you would get taken care of. So the employer that is spending $8,000 to $20,000 a year for insurance for their employee.
Before you go on that, when you say you get taken care of, you mean like the American health system will take care of them?
100%.
Okay, yeah.
Absolutely.
Isn't it because hospitals are nonprofit?
And they have to provide care. And so many people.
Oh, they have to provide the care.
They have to provide
care.
And so many people at the lower levels of the income strata have access to so many programs and you know, federal money in terms of how they can manage those expenses that when you give somebody that, they don't really value it. It's not that valuable to me if I don't have any assets. Oh, Luis, I'm protecting all of your assets from a major medical expense, you know.
House that I rent and the car that doesn't work.
Exactly.
Got it.
Right, and I pay $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a year to give that to you, and you're going, you know, thanks, I guess.
But okay, like, yeah, I get
would
it.
You pay me an extra 10 grand a year? I'd rather have that.
Okay. Right. And then all of a sudden, when these third-party providers come in, they have a whole health experience.
100%.
Got it. Right. All right. Now
so,
I'm saying that.
So now they're getting health care. And they're like, when they have a need and their kid's sick and they pick up the phone, they're talking to a physician immediately. And that situation is getting taken care of. And they're not having to worry about, is my insurance covering this? What's my portion of this bill going to be? Right. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about a group that has 300 or 400 employees, right, they want their employees to be healthy. They want their employees
so they come to work.
Go to the doctor. Right. You don't want somebody that has diabetes not going to the doctor because they're afraid it's going to cost them $100.
Yeah.
Because eventually what's going to happen is they're going to end up in the ER and it's going to be a couple $100,000 medical expense. They don't care because they have a couple $1,000 deductible that they're never going to pay. The insurance company is going to, you know, get billed for it. You're going to eat that cost, Mr. Employer. It's going to come back to you.
With raised rates.
So if you put something in place on the front end that gives your employees care and helps them navigate the maze of the healthcare situation and helps them utilize their insurance as just a tool, it's one tool. Mm-hmm. You have a tool. It's insurance. But there's other tools, right? You're low income and you're paying $5,000 a year for insulin. Through your insurance, is there another avenue that you could be buying that insulin from that's cheaper than using the insurance tool?
Mm-hmm.
Really great for your employees to have that information.
I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. Is this part of two things? One, don't lose that microphone because otherwise we won't hear you.
Yep.
Two, is this, we talk a lot in the United States about healthcare reform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got the single payer idea. We've got universal healthcare, all those different things. Is this a stopgap? Is this something that, because for a while, employee provided healthcare was the stopgap. Right, that was the solution. Your employer provides your health care. Is this concierge service in general going to be the next solution? Do you see that as like an evolving thing?
I do see it as an evolving thing because, you know, we could get a little political here, you know, on some level.
I'm not scared.
But, okay, good. Because, I mean, from my perspective, the free market can solve this problem a whole lot better than government can solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of to take our insurance and make a single payer system where the government handles everything, it's going to be enormously expensive. We're already doing that right now with our 65 and older population, and we can't.
And it's about to run out of funding.
It's bankrupting the country, and we're kind of continuously having to put money in it. So we've already kind of tried that, and it doesn't work.
It's a leading piece of inflation.
Exactly. Right. So
Social Security, by the way.
Yeah, and so how does the average, you know, entrepreneurial small business owner attack this problem, right? I think they attack it this way. They attack it by contracting with local independent, you know, physician groups that can help your employees manage their health and that are not incentivized to bill insurance companies, right? And then your employees have access to care that they need. And on the back end, you can manage the larger expenses with insurance like you still do today.
So this is, okay, hold on. This, I heard you.
Yep.
Let me ask a question here. And this, tell me if this is a little bit different or like a different direction. In general, I agree with you. I've had both experiences. So I lived in Argentina for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. And they have universal health care, right? It's free, but a lot of the nicest companies down there have private health care too. You get private insurance to access to the quote-unquote better doctors. And it's a fractured system because of it. But anything that you need, you can get for free down there.
Sure.
In the United States, we have the complete opposite program. And there's a lot of breaks in how it is served to the consumer,
mm-hmm.
right? We have insurance is all over the map, like you talk about.
Right.
And then, you know, the price of healthcare has gone up with the involvement of insurance, all these different conversations. Or you have examples of, there's a point here, I promise. You have examples of like dialysis, mm-hmm. right? Dialysis treatment should be a completely unregulated market. And then because it's like half regulated by the government, all of a sudden it becomes a closed loop and there's only two big players, right? The idea of the free market in healthcare is like eventually one day to be a kidneys are us. Like if you need a new kidney, there's a company that only does it and they have pushed the price down as far as they possibly can to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Is the concierge service a step in that direction, or is the concierge service adding a layer back into the kind of circle of insurance?
Yeah, great question. That's an excellent question. It's definitely moving us in the former.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's moving us towards a more of a free market, more consumer oriented, right? Because right now the challenge with the current private system is it's fee for service, right? Mm-hmm. Your insurance company contracts with the hospital for a fee. Right, so the mm-hmm. hospital says, okay, knee surgery, right? We're going to charge $50,000 for knee surgery. I'm just making up numbers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Insurance company comes in and says, well, we want to give our members who are part of Priority Health or Blue Cross and Blue Shield, we want to give them a discounted rate. And that discounted rate is going to be $30,000 for a knee surgery, right? Mm-hmm. So that happens all over the board with hundreds of thousands of different claims. And you really, as a buyer of healthcare, have no clue what the real cost is of what you're buying, because it's too many layers in between, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as a business owner, you're contracting with an insurance company to economically purchase healthcare for your employees, right? Basically, that's what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
You're outsourcing the purchasing of healthcare to an insurance company. That insurance company is getting you negotiated, and I'm using, you know, little cute air quotes, negotiated pricing on all the services, right? But is their negotiated pricing fair?
No, because it's a closed loop. You're not a closed loop.
You have no idea what the real price is, right? So now with a couple of years ago, new legislation came out, price transparency legislation. Now hospitals, facilities have to, by law, post all of their pricing online.
Okay, I didn't know that.
So now there's a bunch of companies out there gathering this data and making it digestible to the average consumer. But I can sit down with a self-funded client right now, a group with 300 or 400 employees, and look at all their claims data, and I can show them, hey, you have a negotiated rate with Priority Health on all of these claims that you had last year. Here's what that negotiated rate would have been if you would have been contracted with Aetna. Here's what that rate would have been if you would have been contracted with the Blues. So you can see behind the scenes at what you're really getting in terms of the purchase of those services.
God, this is such a racket.
It is a total racket.
So this is, I don't want to like derail this conversation, but I do have a general question. And this is a very localized question. And I think we have listeners that aren't in Grand Rapids.
Okay.
So Priority Health and Corewell Health, or formerly Spectrum.
Sure.
They're in cahoots.
Sure they are.
How, if they are, they have different leadership, they have different boards, right?
Mm-hmm.
How are they connected, and how can a company, how can, assuming that it was started from the leadership of the hospital, how can they start an insurance company? How can a company that sells a service sell or create a company that pays for the service?
Well, that happens a lot. I mean, if you, just to give you more of a broad example, just as another example, iMed, one of the largest vision insurance companies in the world, right? They are owned by a company called Luxottica.
No. Luxottica, like Ray-Bans and everything?
Luxottica is a massive global brand.
They own Sunglass Hut and Ray-Bans.
They own Ray-Ban. They own Oakley. Lens Crafters. They own Oakley. They own Prada. They own Tom Ford. And, I mean, yeah, the list goes on and on Beer. And on. I'm good. So
all of those. I didn't know it was owned by Luxottica.
So, you know, what do they call it? Vertical integration. It's just vertically integrated, right? So we sell the insurance that drives you to our providers that we own.
And then the insurance, I guess, premium subsidizes back.
Right. It's a financing mechanism.
It basically becomes the software model of having a subscription to the hospital. Exactly. It's basically an overly blown up concierge model.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, the disruption angle here is this, okay? If you have a bunch of physicians that are kind of getting together and saying, we don't like the system, we don't want to be part of this anymore. I don't want to be managing 3,000
patients. Fuck the system.
I don't like it. I'd rather manage 400 people and really take care of them, right? So they're bucking the system, and they're creating their own groups. And the great thing about these groups is they know the system. So now when you're meeting with them, your doctor not only knows how to help you medically, but your doctor has an economical mindset that says, I recognize that you have a $5,000 deductible and that you're paying for this. And how can I help you get what you need in the most economical way?
Got it.
It's
a complete, okay, hold on. I feel like I'm having a breakthrough.
Okay.
I understand everything.
Good.
So back to kind of like the political angle, and tell me if I'm already jumping the gun here. There is a lot of people that legitimately think that the United States will go to universal health care. Let's assume it does happen. First of all, what does it mean for you guys? What does it mean for insurance? Mm-hmm. And are there positives on it? Just positives, not in like what the consumer experiences, but positives in like, hey, we need to break the system. And are there negatives on like what's going to happen overall? And this is just, you know, basically your soft opinion.
Right. And my soft opinion on it. I mean, I just, generally speaking, I'm a free market capitalist guy. I'm fairly conservative when it comes to, you know, the way I think about government and how much power they should have and how much influence they should have, because I used to work for the government and I see how inefficiently they spend the money, and that's my money. And so as a taxpaying, you know, American, I look at that and go, yeah, I don't think you're going to do a very efficient job of consolidating this all together, because really even the federal government can't do this. Okay, with Medicare, for instance, let's just use that as an example. The federal government is managing millions of people on Medicare, right? They can't do it. They can't do it. So they've contracted with private insurance companies to basically manage it for them.
So it's basically Amtrak.
It's exactly what it's not a perfect analogy. So the government is just giving money to insurance companies so that they'll manage all of it. And it's just, you know what I mean? It's the same thing. Government kind of picking winners and losers a little bit on that front. So in the grand scheme of things, I think a single payer system is antithetical to kind of, you know, the American system and the American way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? People would probably disagree with me on that. I that's fair. At the end of the day, what I want is people to have access to really great quality medical care and not have to spend an arm and a leg to do it. Because if you can go out in the market right now, and when in 2018, when my wife and I and our four kids moved back to West Michigan, we purchased a membership to a direct primary care office on the northeast side of Grand Rapids. We paid $200 a month for my whole family. We did that because we wanted it. So, like, if you as a consumer can go out there and for yourself basically buy concierge medicine for 30 or 40 or $50 a month, what does that tell you?
It's an improved product.
It's not that expensive.
Yeah.
Right? Why does it cost $20,000 to insure somebody, you know what I mean, and then they have literally no access to a doctor?
So the price to get the membership price,
yeah,
gives you access. Is there a difference in the final, like, the execution cost? So let's say here's a perfect example. I've had a broken tooth for years.
Okay.
Right? I was trying to do backflips on my wakeboard. Dope. Tell your friends. I did not do backflips on my wakeboard, but I did knee myself in the face.
Nice.
I broke my tooth below the jaw, below the gum line. Hmm. So the tooth doesn't fall out. It's not dead. It's just disconnected, but it's still getting blood.
Yep.
Right? So it's really loose, but it's still there. I have to get it replaced. It's going to cost all of the dollars. And I keep waiting until I get, like, the best insurance to get it done.
Yep.
If I switch to a concierge model through an insurance provider, is it going to change my out of pocket for that specific task, or is the out of pocket overall the same?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, dental is its own separate
animal. Oh, that's true. I did kind of give you a red herring there.
There's a little bit. Yeah. So, like, in terms of, you know, let's just put dental on the shelf for a minute. It's like a whole nother, you know, thing.
Let's say it was a toe,
right? And whatever it was, you get on contact with your team, your mm-hmm. medical team. If it's something that they can take care of, you're not going to pay a dime.
It's covered.
Covered. Right? So let's just, obviously they can't do an MRI on a virtual call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they're going to ask you, Luis, okay, what kind of insurance do you have? That's kind of your initial intake into the system. So they know what kind of insurance you have. They know about a little bit about you. They're dealing with you and whatever medical situation it is you're dealing with. And you come to the point where you need something. You need a test. You need blood work. You need an MRI. Right? The doctor needs more information.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to engage in some way, shape, or form the traditional healthcare system in order to get that done, right? So they're going to work with you and help you accomplish that in the most economically efficient way, period.
In the way that works for you, because they're not getting fee for service paid. Got it.
Precisely. Like, if you have great insurance and they know that, and they know that you could use
you're going to get sent through the ringer.
Exactly.
Got it.
Go over here and get it done. You know what I mean? They're looking out for you. Right. They're mm-hmm. looking out for you. They're looking out for the employer. It helps the employer, too, because as your employees become better healthcare consumers because they have help, it's going to reduce your cost on the back end, because everything your employees buy with your insurance comes back to you in the form of a rate increase. Period. Insurance companies don't lose money.
Yeah.
And I lose the money. And they're going to come. It's all going to come back to you.
The upside down casino model.
It's all coming back to you. So if you can put something on the front end that helps your people be smarter healthcare consumers, and they're getting better coverage, better care, everything's better, right? Like, that's the goal.
That's legit. Makes so much sense. Makes so much more sense. Here's some questions about. So Jackson and I on Saturday, we're going to go to the Robert Kennedy. Conversation. We're gonna do the man on the street thing. We're gonna put microphone in people's places.
Nice.
I'm gonna ask questions. That's great. It's really exciting. I like talking to people that I disagree with, or even if I agree with them.
Sure.
Tell me why. One of the things that, you know, the kind of, I don't want to say the third wave of politics, but, like, you know, the hard left and the hard right
don't actually play ball in the universal healthcare space, but some of these like middle guys or independent guys, Bernie and Robert Kennedy potentially, they kind of bring it to the forefront. What possibility do you see, like, if, as a business owner in the insurance space and in the provider space, what amount of risk management do you put on, like, what happens if universal healthcare comes around?
Yeah.
Is that something that's on the horizon? You're just like, we live in a system that's designed for gridlock. We're good.
I mean, that's a great question. It's not something that keeps me up at night.
Okay. Fair.
At all, because there's always going to be a need for what we do, regardless of the
for an improved system.
100%. Regardless of what the government creates in terms of a tool. There's still going to be need to be people like me at the end that go, yeah, but this is the best way to use it, right? So that
kind of like when I lived in Argentina and I used private healthcare.
Exactly, right? So the government creates something and it's good in some ways, bad in others. How do we create something that dovetails nicely with it so that you can have the best experience possible?
Yeah, I battle a lot. Like overall, I kind of battle with these thoughts. Like they're fucking demons. I like battle with like what I feel about universal healthcare and universal basic income. You know, part of me wants to be like, oh, you know, as a country, we have the ability to provide these means, or if we did have the ability to provide these means, we could, we should. Like, we already provide the roads, we provide the things, but then the other side of it, I've seen how poorly executed it is.
Right.
So the story that I always tell the story all the time about why I don't think that universal health care will work. So we have single-payer health care right now with Obamacare. I lost my job, and I went on the, what is it?
ACA Exchange. Yep, healthcare.gov.
Yeah, healthcare.gov.
Mm-hmm.
I did it. I got my job. I got my insurance, and I got Priority Health, which is Grand Rapids Insurance.
Yep.
And somewhere along the line, I got labeled as a pregnant woman. And when you're pregnant and unemployed and you don't have another carrier, another partner providing insurance or income for you, you're automatically enrolled in Medicaid. Automatically enrolled in Medicaid. And I was neither a pregnant person or a woman, for that matter. And it was a circus to get it fixed. I had to get healthcare.gov because it's a window that you can only do during a certain window. You can only switch it, except for extenuating circumstances. With this, wasn't originally considered an extenuating circumstance to fix it. I had to get healthcare.gov and Priority Health and Medicaid on a phone call at the same time to get this sorted. And it took me 3 weeks or so, and then it took me almost an entire Saturday on the phone. And at that moment I was like, you know what, no matter how much I think I want this, I don't think we're capable of fucking doing it.
Well, you bring up a great point, right? Because when you think about, you know, the single payer system, or you think about Medicaid, right? I mean, just to give you some context, you know, I do some work in the individual space. You know, I've got about 150 clients still from a previous, you know, life, and so I get involved quite a bit on the individual side, and I'm very, very, very familiar with the ACA and how that works, right? But that is a form of Medicaid, right? So, like, if you have an income level at a certain threshold, you just get straight up Medicaid, okay? But if you have a little income above that, then you go on the exchange, and your premium is subsidized by the federal government.
And it's really weirdly done, too. So, like, I was on my own at Zendavesta, like I told you guys, and I was making enough money to pay for my life. And they were like, you are poor because all the money was going to my LLC, and I wasn't taking any dividends, and I just started taking them after the fact, and they never came back for them.
Right.
It's just like, I was just like, this seems broken. This seems broken.
It's broken. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I mean by, you know, the government's going to try to come up with ways to aggregate power. You know what I mean? That's really what, you know, what the end result is. I mean, you know, if you can get as many people, you know, dependent on a particular system, it's really difficult to change that. And then, you know, you've got a battle set up between people who want to change it and people who want to keep it. And then, you know, you've kind of designed a great little political strategy there that becomes really difficult to get over or around.
Do you think this is almost like my tinfoil hat here? So Jackson and I went to Puerto Rico together, and I've been to Puerto Rico a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
So much fun. I say this every time it comes up. If you have never been, you need to go, especially as an American, because you get to use dollars. You don't have to have a passport, and it seems like a different world.
Okay.
It's still America.
Okay.
But when you talk to the people down there, everybody down there has the same opinion, even though they argue on either side. They either like, we should be our own country, we should become a state. They will die on that hill, but everybody agrees on one thing. What we're doing now, this half thing in the middle, is not it. And a lot of them say that, you know, the government, our government, America, the United States, is manufacturing this because when they're in limbo, they have less power. And it just becomes land for the United States. It's somewhere that they can put all of their medical manufacturing and stuff. Is it possible, and again, tinfoil hat, that this limbo bullshit, the single payer, the massive mess with insurance, it's better for everybody on the power end of the spectrum that it's a mess than either it is either than if it's 100% subsidized or 100% free market.
I would tend to agree with you, because I would tend to think that, you know, a mess gives you something to campaign against and campaign on.
Right? For sure.
I'm gonna solve this problem. I'm gonna fix this. You don't have healthcare, and I'm gonna solve it. I'm going to take other people's money and I'm going to make a really great healthcare thing and I'm going to give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that's appealing to a person who doesn't have healthcare. Right? Mm-hmm. It appeals to their emotional, you know, state. It appeals to the lowest common denominator of an individual. It's like, I don't have this. You want to give it to me. I like you. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't mean to like oversimplify it, but I feel like there's a lot of that goes on politically. And I think that this is probably
tons of political posturing. So I have a friend of mine, and I won't say his name because I might be outing him a little bit, but he works in an industry that is directly supported by insurance, right? And he's an executive at the company, and they benefit from the no-fault insurance.
Yep.
And he was like, we play both sides of the aisle all day, every day.
Right.
We want to push and we want to pull all day long. And not to like expo you, but is there a certain amount of both sides are helping you out? Like leaning away from the single payer health system and like being like, oh, maybe more government involvement might benefit you?
Hmm.
Or leaning the opposite direction and be like, no, government, you need to fuck off and we benefit from that too.
Yeah, I tend to like instinctively say I wish the government would back off because it opens up more opportunity for solutions from entrepreneurially minded individuals like myself and others.
And there's no subsidies from the government to get to pay for this product, right?
No.
So it's 100%. I was wondering, like, because when you tell me about it, when Ken's told me about it, it becomes less expensive overall for the provider.
Sure, absolutely.
And it's not because of subsidies, it's just because it's better organized.
Better organized, right? And there's different ways to structure it from a payment standpoint
creative
and that in the end of the day don't hit the bottom line of the employer and doesn't hit the bottom line of the employee, right? So, yes, there's a couple of different strategies that we use.
I think it's cool. Is there anything that we didn't talk about your company that you want to get on camera, by the way?
You know what? I don't know.
My hand's sweating from holding onto the bottom of that microphone so hard.
You know, I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, in terms of, like, how we got started or what really was the kind of the the impetus behind it. I mean, my thought process and wanting to do this goes back quite a while.
You've been like, this is how we could probably do this.
You know, in terms of being in the business, right, and watching certain elements of the business and getting educated over a period of time, you start to go, that's how that works. Oh, I didn't realize there was this layer and that layer and that layer. So the more I've been behind the scenes, like for instance, I worked at MetLife for 5 years, so I got a really good look behind the scenes of how does an insurance company operate, how do they evaluate risk, loss ratios work, how does all that stuff work, right? And then I, you know, through my career, spent time on the self-funded side of the business and working with TPAs and just a variety.
What's TPA?
A TPA is a third-party administrator. Think of it like this: if you're a self-funded employer, like you're not contracting with an insurance company directly to manage your benefits.
Okay.
You're writing down an insurance plan, and it's a $1,000 deductible and a $50 copay for the office and all that stuff. And as an employer, you're giving your employees that plan. And as your employees go out and use that plan, instead of the insurance company paying the bill, as an employer, you're just self-funding it. You're paying the bill, and you're using a third-party administrator to adjudicate those claims. And it's kind of functioning like taking an insurance company and breaking it up into its individual pieces so that you can monitor each one separately.
Is there more risk in that?
No. Well, there's more risk. Yeah, there's definitely more risk for the employer, because the employer is going, well, if I have a bad claims month or a bad claims year, I've got to manage that from a cash flow perspective. And there's a variety of ways you can do that, right?
There's probably insurance for
that. There's insurance for that. Exactly. Yeah, precisely. Right. So it's at what level do you involve insurance? Mm-hmm. It's a different level. You're involving insurance at a much higher level with a self-funded arrangement than you are with a fully insured arrangement. Not to give you so much, you know.
Listen, I want to hear this stuff. You know what I mean? Trying to still have a good product here that
getting
doesn't
in,
lose
getting,
people.
Getting in the weeds a little bit. Sorry about that. But I mean,
it's not your fault. It's mine.
In terms of like evolution, you know, I've been in these different positions and seen it from this angle, seen it from this angle, seen it from this angle. I'm like, okay, there is a way to really put a multitude of solutions together that can really help an employer, right? And so I've taken these varied experiences and varied perspectives and put them together, and it's taken me, you know, a long time to kind of get to that place where I go, okay, I feel like I know enough, and I feel like I have enough experience and knowledge that I can put, you know, the right pieces together to solve problems. You know, that's really it in a nutshell. I mean,
you know, when Ken was talking about it, I was like, oh, this seems like a cool idea. Plus, you like the Grateful Dead. You're always gonna come back.
I love the Grateful Dead.
I don't know. I feel like that was a great way to end it. Is there any big takeaways you want to have for us?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I you know, maybe this, you know, healthcare is not as difficult as people make it out to be. It can be a lot simpler than the way it is today. And I think for a lot of people, the idea of concierge medicine seems just totally unachievable. And it must be just thousands and thousands 100%. Of dollars. And there's no way I could afford that and bring some, democratize something like that down to the everyday man. And I'm here to tell you that there is.
Let me add, before we kind of derail this, how far away do you think we are, and if this is the direction, mm-hmm. are we from concierge medicine being the norm?
Hmm. Oh, quite a ways.
Quite a ways, like yeah. decades or like 4 or 5 years, 6 years, 8 years?
Well, that depends on a lot of things. I mean, you know, the industry right now that is basically sprouting up as a result of the pressures that exist within the market, you know, the doctors and all that stuff, all these companies that are being developed and are growing and are being purchased and are trying to figure out how to scale and trying to figure out how to make it, right? It remains to be seen, I think, what the end, you know, product looks like. Does an insurance company end up trying to gobble up a lot of these players and create a little bit of a different product that isn't like it is today? I don't know. It's going to evolve, and it's hard to say exactly what it's going to look like.
So actually, I do have one last question I thought about earlier on. I just remembered it here.
Yep.
So we're in Grand Rapids. This is a Grand Rapids-based company.
Yep.
It sounds like two of your big partners are Grand Rapids-based as well, and yep. you play ball here. Does the growth strategy for your business, is it really involve Grand Rapids deeply, or is Grand Rapids just the sandbox that you're used to? Is it something like you guys could be the one in Grand Rapids, or is it just like, hey, we have so much growth, there's no reason to waste time staying here?
There's a little bit of a balance there, you know, because I have a great network in Grand Rapids.
Ken does.
Ken has a fantastic network in Grand Rapids, so
there's a whole episode about that.
There's no reason why we shouldn't work in our own backyard. There's a ton of opportunity here. There are great medical providers that are jumping on this and trying to create companies to solve this problem. We're partnering with them. So the opportunity in our own backyard is significant. But at the same time, we're not shying away from working with organizations on a national, you know, front, because we have multiple medical providers, and it just depends on who's the right fit for that company.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, that was awesome. I really do. I feel like I get to talk about, like, I don't even know shit about insurance. I'm just excited about it. Jackson, do you have any questions over here?
No questions.
All right, thank you very much. I really do thank you for coming out.
Absolutely.
This is great. Awesome, dude. How did we do, Jackson?